Welcome to the American Cafe. I'm Ira Melman. Like quite a few areas around the so-called Ring of Fire, Los Angeles has seen its share of earthquake activities over the past month or so. But that's not all.
Well, just here in the last month, we've had a wildfire, we've had a severe rainstorm which caused mud flows and debris flows, we've had an earthquake.
Michael Sullivan is in the cafe with a look at what LA is doing to limit damage and loss of life. Another way to curb dangerous situations is the growing technology that lets motor vehicles communicate with each other.
The way to look at it is the first 50 years of transportation safety have focused on surviving crashes. We see the future as technology that avoids crashes overall.
George Putich has that story. After many a decade of bare heads in the United States, there is an increased yearning for something to cover them.
People of all ages have been embracing the resurgence of headwear.
Bernard Chessman is back in the cafe with that. That and more coming up this week in the American Cafe. A series of moderate earthquakes that rocked Los Angeles recently have reminded residents to be ready for a disaster. Michael Sullivan reports safety experts say every household needs a plan, supplies of food and water, and emergency equipment.
An earthquake of magnitude 5.1 shook the southeastern suburbs of Los Angeles, causing some damage but no major injuries. Nerves were on edge as smaller aftershocks rumbled through the region. At the Los Angeles County Emergency Operations Center, young people sort through supplies, the kind we should all have on hand for any disaster, from flashlights and batteries to emergency blankets. They are training with FEMA Corps under the Federal Emergency Management Agency and the National Service Program AmeriCorps. Ongoing training at this Hilltop Command Center also ensures coordination among emergency responders. LA County has 88 cities and scores of agencies, and Leslie Luke of the Office of Emergency Management says the region has to be ready for any kind of disaster.
Well, just here in the last month, we've had a wildfire, we've had a severe rainstorm which caused mud flows and debris flows, we've had an earthquake.
At the Red Cross in nearby Long Beach, the message is also preparedness, since experts say people should expect to be on their own for at least 3 days after a disaster. They will need their medications, a first aid kit, food and water. Red Cross official Margaret Arbini Madonna says their emergency kit should also include a radio, ideally one like this with several functions.
So it's got an alarm, it's got a light, it's got an AM/FM radio.
She says people should keep copies of important documents in a waterproof package, and it should all be accessible in an emergency kit. She adds that in an earthquake, people need to react when the shaking starts.
So you go under your counter or something to protect your head and neck from falling objects. So drop cover and hold on till the shaking stops.
Earthquakes are a fact of life in California, and a quake of magnitude 8 or higher could strike along the San Andreas Fault in coming decades. The fault runs north to south through the state, and thousands died in its last major rupture near San Francisco in 1906. Scientists say it could well wreak havoc again in Northern California or closer to Los Angeles in the southern part of the state. But smaller earthquakes can be deadly if they strike close to cities, like the magnitude 6.7 quake that hit Northridge, California 20 years ago. It killed more than 50 people. Seismologist Kate Hutton of the California Institute of Technology says an early warning system is now in development, similar to ones now in place in Japan and Mexico City. It would give precious seconds of warning after a trembler has struck the region as ground waves are approaching.
And, you know, get under the desk or get out of the elevator or slow the trains down or, you know, all these different things that could be done in that short amount of time.
But she says there is no way to predict earthquakes, so being prepared is the best defense. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, Los Angeles.
U.S. regulators are close to approving new standards for enabling vehicles to communicate with each other, hoping the new technology will reduce traffic accidents. Within as little as 3 years, automakers may be required to equip all new cars with the so-called vehicle-to-vehicle communication devices. VOA's George Putich reports.
Vehicle-to-vehicle, or V2V, is a short-range communication technology that enables vehicles to exchange vital information information 10 times per second about location, speed, acceleration, and braking. Cars will be able to calculate the hazard risk within about 300 meters and alert their drivers or even take automatic collision avoidance action. The drivers will be able to see, hear, or even feel the hazard signals through vibration of the seat. The U.S. National Highway Traffic Safety Administration expects the new system to reduce the number of car accidents by as much as 80%, especially those where alcohol is not a factor. The U.S. Department of Transportation's Greg Winfrey says the new technology will change the whole attitude toward car crashes.
The way to look at it is the first 50 years of transportation safety have focused on surviving crashes. We see the future as technology that avoids crashes overall.
Critics admit that V2V technology is revolutionary, but warn about possible conflicts in the wireless bands in which it will operate. Scott Belcher is the chief operating officer of the advocacy group Intelligent Transportation Society of America.
If somehow we're sharing the spectrum and there's interference, and so a car that could have, we could have prevented a crash, we are not able to prevent a crash because a signal, because somebody else is using the spectrum.
Belcher says that the public may also be concerned about the privacy and the possibility of tracking individual drivers and their driving habits. Government agencies and the private sector have already invested almost $1 billion in research. Officials expect the new technology will become mandatory by early 2017, and they see it as a first step toward the future 21st century integrated transportation system. George Putich, VOA News, Washington.
The hat is back. The latest annual statistics reveal more than $2 billion in hat sales in the United States. Young people around the world have helped make hats the real sartorial comeback story. VOA's Bernard Chessman put on a hat and went on the trail of hats in New York.
You, John Fitzgerald Kennedy, do solemnly swear.
I, John Fitzgerald Kennedy, do solemnly swear.
It was this event, the 1961 inauguration of President John F. Kennedy in bitter cold weather, no hat, no coat, that set a hatless trend for years to come. Up until that time, no president would be seen without a hat or face criticism for his manner of dress. Wearing a hat was just part of the workaday life in the 19th and early 20th centuries. Hats defined the man and the woman, no matter their status, rich or poor. That was good for the San Francisco-based Gurin Brothers Hat Company, which opened in the late 1800s. After the Kennedy years, the fashion tide turned in the 1990s, thanks to the younger generation. Speaking by Skype, Chief Executive Officer Ben Gurin.
They didn't grow up seeing their fathers or grandfathers wearing hats. But really, people of all ages have been embracing the resurgence of headwear and have been very open-minded in terms of, wearing hats once again.
Gurin Brothers has 30 stores across the United States. Most of their hats are manufactured or completed in the United States by highly trained, well-educated artisans.
Fedoras are funky, a little more dressy, so very versatile, so it's neat.
There's something about someone when they walk out of our shop with a hat on their head. You can see them walk out with just a little bit more oomph to their step, let's say.
In another part of New York City, Barbara Feynman and Julia Knox make hats the old-fashioned way, by hand. It is an entirely different approach to manufacturing. Their hats, which can cost as much as $600, are often ordered for special occasions.
For Ascot in London, in England, which has very specific rules about what you're allowed to wear, and we know what the rules are. Kentucky Derby is the biggest one, because people go to the Derby and they also go to Derby parties.
Feynman and Knox use a lot of antique findings in their hats. They make sure that no two hats are exactly alike. Handmade and local is the key to their success, they say. It's a secret they plan to keep under their hat. Bernard Chessman, VOA News, New York.
Peace After Marriage, a comedy by a Brooklyn filmmaker with Palestinian roots and now on the film festival circuit in the U.S. and abroad, tells a story of love and culture clashes in New York City. VOA's Carolyn Weaver has more.
Peace After Marriage tells the story of Arafat, a lonely, sexually obsessed young man raised in Brooklyn by Palestinian immigrant parents who don't understand his American ways.
If I want to hit him, I will hit him.
Don't hit me! I'm 30 years old! Khalas, yani! Don't disrespect your father.
Writer-director Ghazi Abolui, who also stars in the film, says some of the story is taken from his own life. Soon after he was born in a refugee camp in Jordan, his parents immigrated to the U.S.
Really, all I've ever known is Brooklyn. The big culture shock for me, really, is kind of the reverse. It's not Brooklyn, it's when I go back home. So, and then you see that in the movie.
He's referring to a scene in which Arafat flees an arranged marriage back home on the West Bank, pursued by angry relatives of the jilted bride. Back in New York, desperate for female companionship, Arafat agrees to marry a young woman seeking a fake marriage to obtain permanent U.S. residency status. She's an Israeli.
Yani, she's from Palestine?
We call it Palestine. She doesn't.
Abolui says it's a prototypical New York as melting pot story with no political message.
I always think of the film as a New York comedy. I think people bring in their perceptions and their baggage of the Palestinian conflict or the Israeli conflict. I mean, I was just writing about myself. So I just thought it was really funny taking my life here in Brooklyn and then using, you know, an Israeli girl who would come to New York, because I think it's just to take the politics out, and that's what I'm always looking to do.
Maybe not always. At the film's premiere at the Abu Dhabi Film Festival, Abolui joked that sexual jihad, or an orgy, might help bring peace to the Middle East, and was boycotted by the Arab press. His next film is set in New York in the year after the September 11th attacks, and is a comedy about a young Arab American named Osama who can't get a date.
It's kind of like a film postcard to that time for me, and it's also about kind of regaining hope, but it also shows the city as a city that can really forgive and a city that's really culturally open to letting someone like me regain his life after the fact.
Last fall, Peace After Marriage became the first Arab-directed film chosen to open the Jerusalem Film Festival. It will be commercially released in Turkey next summer. Carolyn Weaver, VOA News, New York.
Deserts are generally known as large expanses of land with such dry weather they're hostile to life. Some deserts are actually lush, with plants and animals that thrive in dry conditions. One of the world's most intriguing is the Sonoran Desert, which spans the southwest U.S. and northwest Mexico. The Sonora Desert Museum gives visitors a world-class experience of the desert life that's hidden all around them. From Tucson, Arizona, Shelley Schlender has more.
As drivers speed down the highways across the vast Sonoran Desert, the only life they see often seems to be giant saguaro cacti, standing alone and silent as sentinels. But at the Sonora Desert Museum, life is everywhere, including on this blustery, scrub-covered bluff, where a museum volunteer uses a loudspeaker to tell a large crowd about one of the most extraordinary birds of prey exhibitions in the U.S. A volunteer trainer raises his arm to send a raptor into the air.
This is a beautiful female red-tailed hawk.
The hawk swoops so close, her wings nearly brush people's heads. To bring her back to his leather-gloved hand, the trainer holds up a strip of meat. Up next, a peregrine falcon. As a grand finale, the trainers give wing to an entire family of russet-feathered Harris hawks. The hawks soar across the valley, then perch on tall saguaro cacti. When their trainers call them in, they suddenly go off script. They dive into the sagebrush and make a kill.
This is a good example of a group hunt. They were all sitting here.
More tranquil moments await visitors who stroll the museum's 3 kilometers of outdoor paths, past yellow desert daisies, pink globe mallow, grasses with blue blossoms, prickly cactus, and 60,000 other plants. All have evolved to thrive throughout the Sonoran Desert on hardly any precipitation. A good example, says museum horticulturalist John Weens, is this desert ironwood tree.
It can go through incredible droughts and die back clear to the ground and re-sprout new trunks from the ground time and time again.
He says there's a reason this world-class zoo is also a botanical garden.
We have a lot of different plants from our region here with interpretation to let them know that animals don't stand alone in nature and neither do plants. It's all interrelated, interlinked.
Interlinked in another desert ecosystem, a green Arizona parrot perches on desert scrub oak. It's not far from a steep cliff with a pond at the bottom and a cave far away at the top. In that cave is a man-sized mountain lion.
Are there mountain lions in this area?
There are tons of them.
Really?
Continuing on the path, visitors reach the backside of that cave, where they discover not a cave wall, but a picture window, behind which is the mountain lion watching them.
Skylar, isn't he cute? Don't you want a kitty like that?
A mother and her preschool son lean forward.
He's a big little guy.
He's a cutie, huh? But you don't ever pet those if you see them in your backyard.
Other exhibits let visitors get up close to more than 200 native desert animals that slither, creep, and fly.
His tail, it makes rattles. And you don't go near that sound because he's warning you that you're getting too close and he'll bite you. He's got fangs in his mouth. You see him?
He has a tongue too.
Yeah, he's got a tongue. A long tongue.
Ah, spider. Eight legs.
So this is the desert blonde spider.
On the nest, there's a hummingbird right there on the nest. He's looking at me.
The museum's marketing director, Rosemary Prodzik, says these native animals in their natural settings are popular.
We're ranked the number 9 museum in the world. And it's based on our ratings on TripAdvisor by people who visit. So it's people like you and me who come and experience it and realize that this place is really a gem.
The museum also leads major conservation efforts throughout the Sonoran Desert region, all part of fulfilling its mission to inspire people to live in harmony with the natural world. For VOA News, I'm Shelley Schlender near Tucson, Arizona.
80s hitmakers Spandau Ballet created quite a buzz during the recent South by Southwest music and film conferences in Austin, Texas. VOA's Catherine Cole reports on the debut of a documentary about the band, Soul Boys of the Western World, and the group's first U.S. show in nearly 30 years.
Spandau Ballet's first hit, To Cut a Long Story Short, charted in 1980. Since then, they've sold more than 25 million albums and played concerts in huge arenas worldwide. Their performance in Austin, Texas, marked the band's first show on a U.S. stage in 28 years. It was also the first time in decades that they had played a venue with room for only 600 people. Drummer John Keeble described the experience as inspiring and fantastic.
You know, it was the smallest gig we've done for many a year. There's something very visceral about being in a small room with people right up close and personal. Probably one of my favorite gigs.
Singer Tony Hadley says playing in a small club means there are no secrets.
There was no trickery. It was just the five guys plugged in. Gary just had four little pedals and that was it. There was no hard disk behind us or anything else. It was totally real.
Formed in the late 1970s in London, Spandau Ballet were leaders in rejecting the extravagant ugliness of the punk music scene and played a leading role in the British New Wave movement called the New Romantics. They changed their look as often as their sound, getting funky with the hit chant number one, I Don't Need This Pressure On.
I don't need this pressure on. I don't need this pressure on. I don't need this pressure on. I don't need this pressure on. I don't need this pressure on. I don't need this pressure on.
But it was when the band released a completely different sort of song, a dreamy synth-pop ballad, that Spandau Ballet had its biggest worldwide hit, True.
I know this much is true.
bass player Martin Kemp says Spandau Ballet's show in Austin left the band excited about the prospect of returning to the U.S. for a full tour.
You know, we've played those songs a million times to people in Europe, and you know what they mean, those songs, to people when you play them. Here we thought maybe the only song everybody's going to know is True, but it wasn't like that at all. Everyone was into the band from the beginning. But I thought it was a really special moment. I agree with John. I actually think it was one of my favorite gigs we've ever done.
So why did it take 28 years for Spandau Ballet to return to the United States? Two reasons. First, the group's 1985 tour was cut short after saxophonist Steve Norman injured his knee in Los Angeles, California. Then, at the end of the 1980s, the group split up after a bitter fight over royalties. Guitarist Gary Kemp is also the band's lead songwriter.
Listen, we found it hard enough to come back to each other. That took us nearly 20 years, let alone come back to America. So it's not like we've been ignoring America for 28 years. We were ignoring ourselves for 20 of those.
Spandau Ballet's breakup is covered in the film Soul Boys of the Western World, which was shown at the South by Southwest conference in Austin. Steve Norman admits that it was hard to watch the documentary in front of an audience.
There's a lot of anguish in there, you know, you can see. We were so close. We went to school together. And then to see how it all fell apart, it's very emotional. And the other day, because there were people there, it became much more emotional. I had tears in my eyes once or twice.
In 2009, Spandau Ballet reunited for a 30th anniversary tour. And true to form, they showed off a new sound with Once More, an unplugged acoustic album. Their next world tour is scheduled to start either later this year or early in 2015. I'm Catherine Cole.
I just want the chance to turn this love around. Keep on searching for the sound. I don't want to do you wrong. I just want to take us back where we belong. We were hot and we were all so strong. Ooh, I know we'll make it if we try.
That's all the time we have for this week's program. Our thanks to executive producer Bob Doty. If you'd like to hear more about these stories, check our website at voanews.com, and we'd love to hear from you. Email us at americancafe@voanews.com, and you can give us a telephone call. Dial the international code, then the number 1 for the United States, followed by 202-205-9942. When you hear the VOA ID, press 05 and then leave your questions or your comments. For all of us here at VOA, I'm Ira Melman. We'll see you next time on American Cafe.